Hi everyone, it's Bridget Bergen in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, October 7th, coronavirus cases are on the rise in New York City, the nation's pandemic epicenter in the spring. But the mayor and governor are at odds.
They also, unfortunately, I think to many, share the quality of believing that they are the smartest person. And so when confronted with an unprecedented health crisis, they allowed that silly, petulant relationship to dominate.
Also on the show, we've lost over 200,000 Americans to COVID, but right now our mourning process looks quite different.
I think we've seen the incredible outpouring of different kinds of public mourning and community activism that have really filled the spaces left vacant by our federal government.
Plus the Nobel Prizes in science, who wins them and who doesn't.
What would science look like if we had always included those we have been actively excluding? I promise you, it would be different.
We start today here in New York City. 7 months ago, it was the nation's epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic. In response, officials closed all non-essential businesses. The city essentially shuttered against COVID-19. And as the city grappled with the spread of the disease, its top leaders, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, were rarely in lockstep about how to protect New Yorkers.
The New York City public schools will remain closed for the remainder of this school year.
There has been no decision. That's the mayor's opinion.
What we've often seen is if someone disagrees with him openly, some kind of revenge or vendetta follows.
The NYPD and the mayor did not do their job last night.
But eventually, the closures worked. Cases went down, the curve was flattened by summer. Now, the picture is changing. Coronavirus cases are ticking back up in New York City. In response, Cuomo on Tuesday announced zoned closures and restrictions in virus hotspots in the state, most of which are in New York City.
Testing for schools in the yellow zone starts next week. And I am more and more concerned about schools the more experience we have.
But like deja vu from the spring, he and the mayor had mixed messages about the way ahead, leaving politicians, the media, and the public demanding answers.
We are prepared to implement as soon as tomorrow morning in those 9 zip codes once we have the sign-off from the state.
And while New York City has its own particular brand of political infighting, tension between mayors and governors across the country and between governors and the federal government has been one of the defining features of this pandemic. Today, we zoom in on New York City for a look at how the early epicenter of the pandemic is faring today as cases increase, how leaders are reacting, and how tensions echo those we've seen among leaders across the country in the response to COVID-19. I've got two people here to help me with that. Josefa Velasquez, senior reporter for The City, a nonprofit newsroom covering New York City. Great to have you here, Josefa.
Thank you for having me.
And Joseph Sexton is a senior editor at ProPublica and former metropolitan editor at The New York Times. Joseph, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
Joseph, let's jump right in with the latest news about schools and business closures here in New York City. What have we heard from both the governor and the mayor?
So earlier this week, the mayor proposed to close schools and non-essential businesses in 9 zip codes in New York City where there have been mounting cases of COVID spreading within the community. Naturally, within a matter of days, Governor Andrew Cuomo has come out with his own plan that is slightly more confusing. There are 3 color-coded zones, red being the most intense, where schools will be shut down, non-essential businesses will close, and these maps that the governor has displayed all throughout Brooklyn and places in Queens show sort of hot zones, and it almost looks like a target or a bullseye on where there are increased cases of COVID. The thing that we're all trying to figure out now is what happens to some of these businesses that are in the crosshairs of the intersection of 2 zones, and what happens to parents, really, who might have a child that goes into school in a red zone and another child that goes to school in, let's say, a yellow zone, because it's just that confusing.
Wow. So, Josepha, we'll get into some of the details of the plan, but just pulling back, this feels like a big change from where we were just a few weeks ago here in New York. Do you have a sense of how communities and businesses are responding to the uptick in new cases and the prospect of these new restrictions?
Yeah, so it seems that everyone is still in shock because everything is sort of happening so quickly. It really feels like we're back in mid-March and in the early days of the pandemic where you have the mayor and the governor pointing fingers at each other and really causing mass confusion. You know, there are a lot of businesses that have been struggling for the last few months because of the pandemic who are now trying to get some stable footing and continue on with life. We're now being told, okay, you have to shut down now. We're talking about gyms, salons, and things of that nature. So it's really confusing for business owners who have dealt with, you know, a lot in these last few months.
When I am not sitting in the seat, I cover New York politics. And this inability of Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio to get on the same page is not exactly unique to this moment, Josepha. How would you describe their holdup throughout this crisis, though?
It's been childish and contentious, and I think that's probably the most kind I could be about that. I mean, this feud between them goes back to the better part of a decade at this point. It started out back in 2015 when the mayor wanted to come up with his proposal for 3K. It has gotten petty enough to include what happens to a deer that got loose in Harlem. And now with the pandemic, it started in mid-March when Mayor de Blasio wanted to do a shelter-in-place order similar to what was going on in California. And Governor Cuomo said, no, 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 you can't do that without my express permission. Ultimately, Governor Cuomo did do a shelter-in-place quarantine order for the state a few days later. And recent analysis by the New York Times said that that stalemate and that holdout, you know, could have spared a bunch of people's lives and could have actually increased the likelihood of COVID spreading among the community.
Josepha, you have gone deep on both how these leaders have handled the crisis since the beginning. So bring us back to earlier this year. How did Cuomo and de Blasio address the pandemic in the beginning, and where were they at odds?
Well, neither man has, you know, covered themselves in glory in this. And, you know, while it may be painful for them or their supporters to hear it, there are folks who would, you know, I think, credibly draw parallels between the two men's performance and that of the president. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go back and look at Governor Cuomo's handling and public statements around the crisis in February and March, which really was the sort of decisive moments in this for New York. He downplayed the size of the risk. He seemed to be dismissive of some of the experts. He put an enormous reliance on the idea of testing as the sort of panacea for how you should attack the thing. And for many people, you know, it bordered on the smug and the arrogant. You know, he said in early March, you know, this is not our first rodeo, suggesting they, you know, had great experience in responding to infectious disease pandemics, whether that have been their experience with Ebola or H1N1. But, you know, they were dismissive of the sort of alarms being rung by the experts and the epidemiologists, and they paid an enormous price for it.
You've compared the situation in New York City to how San Francisco's mayor, London Breed, and California's Governor Gavin Newsom addressed the crisis in the early spring. How did that differ to what we saw in New York?
Well, I mean, one of the striking things about the what Josepha has, I think, properly characterized as a sort of juvenile feud between Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio is in many ways they're sort of similar creatures, right? They're both of the same age. They're both fancy themselves to be progressive Democrats. They both cut their political teeth in, you know, working for the Clintons, whether it was Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton. But they also, unfortunately, I think, to many, share the quality of believing that they are the smartest person. So when, you know, confronted with an unprecedented and novel health crisis, they allowed that city silly sort of petulant relationship to dominate. Communication was lacking. The city had to watch the governor's nuances in order to figure out what he was actually planning to do. In one of the more remarkable findings of our reporting, the governor actually ordered his own health department to not communicate with the New York City Health Department during the absolutely critical days in February and March of the crisis. A sort of astounding
chilling,
fact.
Really.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, and again, you know, not to overplay the parallel, but not, you know, unlike presidents demonstrated dismissiveness of, you know, of the experts and the CDC. And I mean, the New York City Health Department is one of the, I think, undisputed great jewels in the world of public health. And they were, and it was sidelined by both Cuomo and their, and the mayor. And, you know, it was no surprise that the city's health commissioner ultimately resigned.
Josepha, as Josepha is pointing out, we have seen no real federal leadership to the states in terms of responding to this crisis. So what have state leaders been left to do elsewhere? It seems like there's a bigger story here about the continued need for states and local governments to really just feel their way through the dark. And obviously, in this case, butting heads in the process.
Right. And particularly to blue states, given that the federal administration is controlled by Republicans, you are having a lot of blue states that saw early surges in COVID cases sort of fend for themselves. It turns out that, you know, New York and other states have been reliant on private institutions and just their own political will to get PPE. And that means masks, gloves, and much coveted N95 masks, ventilators, things like that. And really left in the dark in terms of what comes next. Now we're seeing red states and, you know, more so purple states having an increase in the number of cases. So the federal government, you know, you would think would step in, but as Donald Trump proclaimed on Twitter yesterday, stimulus talks have, he's walked away from stimulus talks, sort of leaving everyone in the lurch for what comes next and the possibility of any sort of federal assistance, whether that's another stimulus check for people who have been out of work, or whether that is more money for hospitals and healthcare, is, you know, left with a giant question mark and a TBD.
Those closures that we talked about at the start will begin shutting down schools and some businesses in new portions of the city as soon as today through the end of the week. For you both, Josepha, what do we expect to come in the future as we continue down the path of this crisis?
So in these zones, the state is supposed to reassess within after 14 days. So within 2 weeks from now, it's unclear whether the zones will grow and expand and bleed into other areas. But I think the only thing that we can expect in the next, you know, coming days is just mass chaos. Anyone who's seen these maps and started zooming in on them realizes that, oh, one of these red zones intersects through half of a block. So what happens if you're a business owner who works on one side of the block and you're closed, but a restaurant across the street is open? What happens if you're in a school that is in the red side of the block and then there's another school on the orange side of the block or yellow side of the block? It's just confusing.
I mean, look, this virus has defeated every, you know, exercise in optimism from the get-go. You know, and people have long predicted that New York would experience a second wave or a second surge. I don't see any reason to disbelieve that that will happen or that it's already underway. So I would expect things to get more challenging, more complicated. The great hope is they don't necessarily have to become as deadly as they were in March and April.
Josepha Velasquez is a senior reporter for The City, a nonprofit newsroom covering New York City. And Joseph Sexton is a senior editor at ProPublica and former Metropolitan editor at The New York Times. Joseph and Josepha, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
On Saturday night, Jonathan Price, a 31-year-old black man, was shot and killed by a police officer in Wolf City, Texas. According to Price's family, he had been trying to intervene in a dispute between a man and a woman near a convenience store when the police were called. Officer Sean Lucas showed up to the scene where he reportedly attempted to detain Price, who walked away from the officer. Lucas then used a taser on Price before shooting him multiple times. On Monday, Officer Lucas was arrested and charged with murder. The law enforcement agency investigating Price's killing released a statement saying that in a preliminary investigation, they found Lucas's actions to be unreasonable. Joining me now to discuss this is Mark Haslett, news director for KETR in Northeast Texas. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Mark, beyond the basics of the events that led to Officer Lucas killing Jonathan Price, how much do we know about this shooting?
We know very little. We know basic details. It happened Saturday night around 8:30 near the Quick Check gas station convenience store, which is right off the main intersection in Wolf City, which is a town of about 1,500 residents. A man and a woman there were in some sort of argument. Perhaps there was a physical fight. We know that Jonathan Price attempted to intervene in the conflict. One officer responded to a report of the disturbance, and that officer tased and then shot Jonathan Price fatally.
The Texas Rangers, the law enforcement agency investigating the case, released a statement on Monday saying their preliminary investigation determined that Officer Lucas's actions were, quote, not objectionably reasonable. Do you know what they meant by that?
I think they might have meant objectively reasonable, which is a legal phrase that you hear in discussions of qualified immunity. And in layman's terms, your paraphrase earlier was correct. It seems that the Texas Rangers' preliminary investigation found that Officer Lucas's actions were unreasonable, and that led to his arrest Monday night. He's charged with murder and is being held on a $1 million bond.
There was a vigil held to honor Jonathan Price on Monday in Wolf City. I'm wondering if you can tell me what you heard from participants at that vigil.
The main thing that I took from that vigil was an experience of the deep pain that people in Wolf City are feeling. There was mourning. You heard and saw evidence of people's suffering. There was some anger, but the main thing that I took away from that vigil was deep sorrow and bewilderment, confusion. Mm. This is a small town where people, for the most part, get along. This town has a good reputation regionally, and people there are crushed by these events.
Mark, how are people reacting locally to the relative speed with which Officer Lucas was arrested?
There is a sense of relief, not satisfaction, though, because, of course, people know that this is just the first step in a very long process. People are hoping for justice to prevail in this case, not out of a desire for vindication, but simply to see justice served. But I will say that people are generally relieved, and even though the attorney for the family has said that the arrest should have happened much sooner. Many people are pleased that the arrest was made about 48 hours after the incident.
Mark, what are the racial demographics of Wolf City, and how does it tend to lean politically?
It's mostly white. African Americans are the largest ethnic minority in Wolf City. This is a very conservative part of Texas. Typically in this region, Republicans win elections by about 3-1 margins. This is the 4th U.S. Congressional District, which is the district that sent current Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe to Washington. The Democratic Party did not even field a candidate for Congress in the 4th Texas District in 2016 and 2014. So this is a very solidly Republican area. I will say that political differences did not seem to be relevant in the reaction to this event. People who might disagree politically about a number of topics, including the Black Lives Matter movement and the conversations about race and policing in this country this year, those differences were not apparent. The community was pretty much unified in their support of Jonathan Price and his family. I have not heard or read anyone defending this officer's actions outside of the officer's attorney, who released a statement yesterday.
Have there been any other notable incidents of police brutality in Wolf City in recent years? And did any of the demonstrations that took place this summer take place in Northeast Texas against these broader issues of police brutality and a sort of racial justice uprising?
There were no reported incidents of that sort of thing in Wolf City. As far as what happens in this part of the state, this region, I can't speak to that because I don't know. I only know what is reported. So what is reported might or may not correspond with reality. But as far as what's reported, we don't have many reports of that sort of thing in Northeast Texas. It certainly doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. But for the most part, this is a very quiet part of the state.
In just in our last 15 seconds, what happens next with Jonathan Price's case?
We'll be looking to see how swiftly the Texas Rangers and the Hunt County District Attorney's Office pursues this case, and we're looking to learn of a timeline for a grand jury.
Mark Haslett is news director for KETR in Northeast Texas. Thanks so much, Mark.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
National conversation around police violence has focused on police shootings, but a comprehensive year-long investigation from the Marshall Project is shedding light on another lesser-known form of violence that causes harm to thousands every year: attacks by police dogs. According to their report, there's little oversight on how departments train and use these animals, despite cases like this one out of West Montgomery, Alabama in 2018.
There was a call late at night about a person in an unoccupied house. The police, the Montgomery City Police, sent in the canine unit. They found Joseph Petaway, 51, in the house. He had been fixing up the house earlier in the day. The family said he had a key and had permission to sleep in this small house. The canine found him, bit him. The bite lasted maybe 2 minutes, and Joseph Petaway bled to death.
That's Challen Stevens, editor and investigative reporter for the Birmingham News, Huntsville Times, and Mobile Press Register, who co-reported the investigation. That case is the worst case scenario, but it points to the risks of a system with little accountability. So as the nation examines policing, why isn't there more attention to how and when police dogs are employed? Abby Van Sickle is here to talk about all of this. She's staff writer for the Marshall Project covering criminal justice and was the other reporter on this investigation. Abby, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Abby, why did you begin this investigation about police dogs?
You know, it really started with a string of cases in Alabama where Challen and I started to try to understand the scope of how often police dogs are used to bite people, what kind of injuries people would suffer from these bites, and then what oversight there was. And the more cases that we saw, the more we realized that this was not just happening in Alabama, but was actually happening, you know, coast to coast and everything in between.
When researching police dog bites, how tough was it to find that information?
You know, some things were pretty simple to find if there had been local news coverage of an incident, especially if there's sort of a video involved. We would see local news stories, but what we really didn't see was any kind of national examination trying to put these incidents together. And that's when we started requesting data from departments, and it got a lot more difficult to find things like how often are these dogs used, how often do they actually bite people, and what kind of accountability is there when a bite happens, especially if there's a dog that has, you know, bitten numerous people or an officer who's been involved in lots of incidents. We started to see, you know, we wanted to see if there was any kind of national database tracking this, and we didn't find that. So we started to try to build something where we could see the scope.
Abby, what kinds of injuries do these dogs inflict?
This is one of the things that surprised me most in the reporting is the severity of some of the injuries. So what we found is that it's not a dog bite like you might think of, you know, like a nip from a family pet. What we saw were injuries that, you know, people would suffer lifelong consequences from these dog bites. We saw people who had lost their scalps, who had lost limbs, who had these scars that, you know, they would carry with them throughout their lives. And so that seemed to be, you know, an important thing that came from a lot of the interviews we had with victims of the bites, that they really carried this with them forever.
Abby, how much funding is allocated to the training and use of these dogs?
You know, I think that's an excellent question and something that we would really like to know. One thing that we did determine is that, you know, each department has a lot of discretion in how and when they use the dogs, how many dogs they have. We found some departments that the dogs, you know, are donated through foundations to the departments. There is no clear, you know, clear process for each department. It's very much, you know, something where you have to get into the weeds of a particular agency to understand.
Do we know how many people are getting bitten by police dogs and how big this issue is? And to what extent race or gender play into these numbers?
So what we can say about the number is that we looked at a medical study that examined police dog bites in emergency rooms. And that study estimated there were a few thousand bites a year. We have been able to track bites by the 20 largest municipal policing agencies. So we have some sense, you know, to try to back that number up. But we don't know, you know, a precise number for how many bites there are each year in the United States. As far as race and gender, one thing from the cases, we examined about 140 cases from the last couple of years, and the overwhelming number of people were men. We found very few women, and that's also backed up by the academic studies we've been able to find. With race, it's a little bit more difficult because we had asked departments specifically for race data, and we don't have that from very many departments. We do have hints that there, in some places, that there's been disproportionate use of the dogs on people of color. We see that in the Department of Justice investigation into Ferguson. We see it in an examination from a few years ago of the LA County Sheriff's Department. We see it in in a few places, but we really would love to be able to take a systemic view of this from departments throughout the country.
Abby, who trains these dogs, and are there specific guidelines for their training?
So that's, again, an agency-specific thing. So some departments, large departments, will have training within their own policing agency. And we, as reporters, spent time watching some of those trainings. But also there are, you know, small kind of mom-and-pop trainers throughout the country, and then some sort of independent larger training organizations. It's sort of a hodgepodge, again, very department-specific. And there are not national requirements for training in any kind of standardized way.
Given that there's no consistency in the training, is there consistency in the types of crimes that have to be committed in order for dogs to be used?
That's another thing that we found is very dependent on the agencies. So in some agencies, we found to use the dog, it has to be a very serious crime, a violent felony with a very specific list of the kinds of cases. In other places, there's broad discretion for officers. We also found supervision really depends on the agency. In some places, a supervisor really has to sign off before a dog can be used. And in other places, the dogs we found had been used on people who were accused of very low-level crimes. We're talking traffic stop, an expired license plate, things that are, you know, considered very low-level.
Abby, just briefly, given that police reform and racial equality are in such this in this spotlight right now in this country, do you think departments will stop using police dogs, or is there any organization fighting this?
So we are starting to see a reexamination of the use of police dogs in some departments throughout the country. Salt Lake City Police Department had a video that was released recently showing a man with his hands in the air as the dog was being released on him and biting him. And in the wake of that, the department has suspended the use of these kinds of dogs, the kind of dogs that are used to bite people, as they examine that incident.
Abby Van Sickle is staff writer for the Marshall Project covering criminal justice. Thanks for this information and joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
This past weekend, 20,000 folding chairs, each representing 10 people, filled the Ellipse Lawn in Washington, D.C., just south of the White House. The installation was part of a National Day of Remembrance organized by the group COVID Survivors for Change to honor more than 200,000 lives lost to the pandemic so far.
Today, we come together because we're all in pain, because we have lost so much. Friends, family, jobs, and our livelihoods, our sense of security, and our way of life. It's been over 8 months of this devastating pandemic, and we have not yet had this moment.
That was singer and longtime activist Dionne Warwick speaking at Sunday's remembrance. The grassroots organized event is just one of the many ways people are mourning publicly as the coronavirus pandemic continues. In recent months, people have turned to everything from small memorials to protests to social media to express their collective grief. Here to discuss that and more is Mickey McAleer, a professor of history at the University of Connecticut and author of The Politics of Mourning, Death and Honor in Arlington National Cemetery. Mickey, welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me back.
Mickey, the last time you were on the show, it was when the death toll had reached 100,000 people. Now we're at more than double that, with more than 200,000 deaths. How has the public response to our collective loss shifted since the spring?
I think we've seen two things, both the incredible outpouring of different kinds of public mourning and community activism that have really filled the spaces left vacant by our federal government, by state authorities, and a more official national public mourning. So I think we've seen a really glorious response from people who refuse to be silent in their mourning and refuse to see their loved ones and their friends go uncollectively mourned. By the same token, we've reached this grim number and still see so many unwilling to acknowledge the profound loss to this country and the profound losses globally due to this illness.
Mickey, did we see the same scope of tributes we saw at the 100,000 milestone?
No, and that's something that I think is really important to note and really incredible, and that's in this time we've seen people build incredible coalitions and complicated protests. We've seen the events this weekend and the really stunning visual of those 20,000 chairs, empty chairs on the Ellipse. And that takes an enormous amount of collective effort and organizing. And so in the months since June, we've seen that. We've seen that, I think, in large part because of the ongoing uprisings following the murder of George Floyd. I think we're seeing just a groundswell of activism and refusal to see some lives not valued and some losses not valued.
There has just been this flood of numbers, just in terms of the scope of the pandemic. I'm wondering, how does the media coverage we consume shape how we perceive the toll of this virus?
I think it has a profound impact. And we talk a lot and I think many of us are incredibly concerned about the kind of information silos that Americans exist in at this point, and how we tend to be in echo chambers of people of like mind and similar politics. And one of the things that happens because of that is this kind of organizing also stays within certain silos. So I would venture that you could go on the streets and ask people about the events of this last weekend. Many probably wouldn't know what had happened. And so I think we're seeing different kinds of news reaching different people, and that we are losing that kind of collective media consciousness and dialogue about these grassroots efforts.
I think to your point, President Trump and other members of his administration have routinely downplayed the magnitude of this virus and the loss that's resulted from it. Even you know, as the president was in and out of the hospital over the weekend. And I'm wondering to what extent you feel that has impacted our perceptions of it and therefore how we collectively mourn.
Yes, I think this is a real struggle, and we are you know, dealing with an administration that has refused to respond initially or correct the problems in the national response. And that has resulted in many, many unnecessary deaths and unnecessary infections. The impact of downplaying the consequences and to public health and to American lives is devastating, while simultaneously flaunting the disproportionate health care and access that some Americans have in this country while others do not.
In the absence of a government-led day of mourning, we have seen these grassroots efforts fill the gap. What are some of the other ways we're seeing people mourn collectively right now?
We're seeing everything from very localized community efforts, church-based efforts, organizations that are looking to honor members of their community in photographs through the reading of names, and both pulling people together either on social media or in socially distanced ways in public spaces. We're also seeing these large collective efforts like the one on Sunday that really represents a wide swath of different political positions and different coalitions of groups. I mean, I think we should also look at the March for the Dead organization, which held an event a couple of weeks ago in New York City, and the kind of activist mourning and public mourning that both calls the state, calls people to account for the failures, but also looks to build something new in this really important coalition of different organizations represent this organizing work and this real groundswell. And I think an incredibly inspiring and hopeful picture of responses to these losses and to the need for a national, large, collective processing and mourning and recognizing.
Mickey McAleer is a professor of history at the University of Connecticut and author of The Politics of Mourning, Death and Honor in Arlington National Cemetery. Mickey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Has your community been memorializing COVID deaths in recent months? How are you honoring lives lost? Give us a call at 877-869-8253. That's 877-869-8253. This week, scientists across the world are celebrating the winners of the most prestigious award in science, the Nobel Prize. A few notable winners: Andrea Ghez, who won this week for her contributions to physics, and Emmanuelle Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna, who won the Chemistry Prize for their work on CRISPR gene editing tools. Three of the eight winners this year are women, although none of the winners is a person of color. Since the awards were first given in 1901, nearly every winner of the Nobel Prize for Science has been a white man. In 119 years, only 23 women have won. A black scientist has never won. The homogenous legacy of Nobel Science laureates points to larger issues like global racial and gender education gaps and the hardships women and especially people of color still face working in STEM academic research. Claudia Rankins is the program officer for the Historically Black Colleges and Universities undergraduate program and for National Science Foundation Society as well. She also founded the Society of STEM Women of Color. She spoke to Tanzina Vega yesterday with her personal opinions, not as a representative of the NSF, about the issues that have prevented women and people of color from winning Nobel Prizes for science, including some famous snubs in Nobel history, like Rosalind Franklin.
So first of all, each prize is limited to three people, so there will always be those that are left out. But historically, it has always been that the men were the ones who received the prizes, whose names went on the publications, which has something to do with who wins the prize, right? If you are not first author, or your name has even been omitted from the publication, people don't know you're part of the team. So these women were never allowed to be the authors on the papers of the work they did. Also, to be a nominator for a Nobel Prize, you have to be invited by the Nobel Committee. So who is on the Nobel Committee? Who has traditionally been on that committee? Who do they know? Who do they think knows enough to nominate Nobel Prize winners? Those are all good questions to look into.
There is still, Claudia, a significant gender gap and a significant racial gap among those who pursue STEM degrees. Why do you think the gap still exists?
So I would say at this point more so the racial gap maybe than even the gender gap. I mean, it's been the case that lately some women, white women, have been getting the Nobel Prize and been successful otherwise. The women's movement historically has been led by white women and really for white women, and it has advanced them. So there are some fields in science where there are now more women than men. That goes less so for people from racial and ethnic minorities. The discipline traditionally has not been very welcoming to anyone who wasn't part of the club. That's just changing recently. I mean, efforts are under the way to change that. But it was very hard for, in this country, for example, for black scientists to gain a foothold. It hasn't been until maybe the mid-1960s where in the South they were allowed to attend universities and graduate schools that were predominantly white. So, you know, these carry over to the present day.
Is there anything being done, Claudia, to increase the participation of black and brown people and women specifically in STEM fields right now that you think is of note?
There are many noteworthy efforts. I would say over the last, I mean, these efforts have been ongoing, but particularly in the last 20 years or so. I mean, they're private efforts, institutions are making efforts, national funding agencies of science are certainly making efforts, great strides, and have programs. But it's sort of very hard to change a system that is so entrenched. So it'll take more time. I am very hopeful that among the young scientists that I know, many of whom are black women, that the future Nobel Prize winners reside in that group. That said, we could definitely do more. We could make the disciplines more inviting. We could also be more inviting to diverse ideas. I mean, what we consider to be science and how we do science has been dictated for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years by one group of people, white men, basically. There may be different ways of looking at science. Different groups may have different ideas of what's important to study or what science should be like. We see that right now with the COVID-19 epidemic, how it disproportionately affects certain populations. it definitely shows the need to bring diverse thinkers into science.
Claudia, is there anything or anyone in particular that you're looking for today who you think is a rising star in the sciences?
You know, I was thinking of some names, and two came to mind in my discipline. I'm a theoretical physicist, so these are the people I know. There are two young women in particular, and I'll tell you their names. Chanda Prescott-Weinstein and Jedida Eisler. They both are cosmologists. There are probably hundreds of young black faculty like that, but people like that I look for being that next generation who hopefully the Nobel Prize Committee will look at 20 years from now and see in their body of work, which will be equivalent to that of all other candidates, and think of them as worthy of that prize.
I mean, I guess a big question would be, what would science have looked like if the Nobel Prize had been more inclusive historically?
Oh, my goodness, yes. What would science look like if we had always included those we have been actively excluding? I promise you, it would be different. I promise you there would be some issues that we are grappling with currently that we could maybe solve easier. Because what we study is what we think our communities need, right? What's important to our communities. So I would imagine what indigenous scholars study would be different from what is currently being studied and probably benefit the environment much more in many ways, right? What those issues are that are important to the communities that need to be studied. We probably have a way to deal with lead poisoning in the water and all these other issues that disproportionately affect black and brown communities.
Claudia Rankins is the program officer for the Historically Black Colleges and Universities undergraduate program and for the Centers of Research Excellence in Science and Technology at the National Science Foundation. She also founded the Society of STEM Women of Color. Claudia, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. You can give us a call about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also tweet at me, at Bridget Bergen. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.